Welcome to Leading Lines, a podcast on educational technology from Vanderbilt University. I'm your host, Derek Bruff, director of the Vanderbilt Center for Teaching. In this episode, the newest member of the Leading Lines team, Melissa Mallon, brings us an interview about teaching critical media literacy. The interview features a faculty member, Natasha Casey, who teaches communications at Blackburn College in Illinois, and a librarian, Spencer Brayton, a library manager now at Waubonsie Community College, also in Illinois. While Brayton was at Blackburn College, he and Casey collaborated to bring their respective fields, information literacy and media literacy, together, developing and team teaching a course on media and information literacy. The course took a critical look at the topics, meaning that there was a particular focus on issues of power and control in digital media. Melissa has a new book out exploring the ways faculty and librarians can partner to teach digital literacies, so this episode's interview was right up her alley. She talks with Casey and Brayton about working across disciplinary silos, helping students think critically about digital media, team teaching a new course, and practicing public scholarship through blogs and Twitter.
I'm so pleased to have on the phone with me Spencer Brayton and Natasha Casey, who are co-workers at Blackburn College in Carlinville, Illinois. And I thought that maybe we could start by Spencer and Natasha talking a little bit about how the two of you know each other or how you came to work together.
We started our work when I was at Blackburn College as well. My first year there as library director, and Natasha had me asked if I would come in and speak with her class about, you know, library resources. And it was a media literacy course. And I thought, wow, this sounds a lot like information literacy. And so, you know, I was looking at her syllabus and what she had been doing in the class. And I saw sort of some paths crossing in terms of media literacy and information literacy. And that's sort of where our work started and conversations have started.
So, Natasha, I was just curious, from your perspective, Spencer had this sense that you were actually covering a lot related to information literacy. Did you realize that at the time? Had you even heard that term before?
I mean, I'd love to say I did and sound, you know, fantastically up on lots of fields, but in reality, I hadn't. I mean, I'd heard the term, but I had a very sort of skills-based, sort of prescriptive idea of what information literacy was. And I wasn't at all familiar with the critical information literacy sort of component of the field, if you can call it a field. So I didn't have any idea. So it was only really when we started delving a little bit further and looking at the ways in which, what were the commonalities and what are the ways in which these two areas overlap, that we started to see, this is something we should definitely collaborate on.
So was there anything particularly surprising or interesting to you when you were looking at that over the sort of overlapping topics?
Yeah, definitely. Like I said, I think it kicked into another gear when we realized that there's this critical strand in both of the fields. And, you know, I'd only been familiar with the media literacy component. But just basically, you know, questions of questioning knowledge, power, how do you know what you know, these sort of big meta questions that you're always trying to get students to wrestle with, and knowing that those kinds of things were also a big part of the information literacy field, I think, became the sort of building block for our collaboration.
Can you talk a little bit more about the critical aspect of this? So maybe a little bit from the two of you on the critical information literacy, critical media literacy overlap. But I think it would be helpful for our listeners to hear your perspectives on what critical means in this regard.
Sure. I know for me, after I had sort of, you know, seen what Natasha was working with in terms of media literacy, and I had started reading some more critical information literacy pieces from the library field, the Critical Library Instruction edited volume, I think by Library Juice Press, and talking with Natasha about it, and sort of applying that critical theory and critical pedagogy to information literacy. And we were meeting and talking about that, and a lot of it was able to transfer over to sort of the more critical media literacy practices. Is that right, Natasha? Is that how?
Yeah. And I think both for both of us, we were somewhat upset with the ways that the sort of skills based approaches that are still popular in some aspects of both information literacy and media literacy seem to be what most of our colleagues thought of when media literacy or information literacy was brought up. You know, I often get a sort of a typical response from other colleagues, which is like, you know, oh, please teach those kids to stay off Twitter, or isn't Instagram terrible today? You know, so this sort of, you know, finger wagging approach. So we also wanted to balance that out, but also we wanted to complicate, like I said before, these notions of power, authority and knowledge. You know, we wanted to facilitate this kind of higher order critical thinking and go beyond these kinds of checklists, like I said, these sort of skills based approaches, and for students to sort of seriously consider the ways in which authorities of whatever sources they're used should be challenged, you know?
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I think it's particularly poignant right now, talking about ideas of power and sort of a higher level of communication, particularly on things like Twitter or other social media platforms. Can you talk a little bit about how you approached that with students and what their reaction was?
I think for, you know, when we use Twitter in the classroom, there's some students, you know, some people tend to think that students know how to use all the social media and these different, you know, apps, you know, but they don't, some don't. And so to think about having to create a Twitter account and tweet is completely new for them. So we have to spend some time going over how that works. And we also, you know, we do use Twitter, but we also talk about how social media, you know, looks at your content and sort of monitors your data, right? And so we also have to, you know, in terms of the critical piece, we have to sort of let them know about those issues as well. So we don't just have them, you know, do Twitter without talking about those aspects of privacy and things like that. We find though that especially as we get further in the class with the class and different iterations and new projects, and we found that we had students post takeaways after every week in the class, and we found that sort of that content really powerful in terms of what they were learning. That was something really valuable.
Were there any particular takeaways that seemed to resonate through many of the reflections?
Natasha, do you remember any that stand out specifically?
I mean, for us is, I mean, there's not, I mean, off the top of my head, I can't think of, you know, specific ones, but it's more about just having students be reflective about the process and getting them to understand, you know, how media works, who owns media, these sort of critical questions, but at the same time, understanding that there's a lot of pleasure to be derived from their media use. So again, you know, it's not just about finger wagging, but it's getting them to understand what they're doing. And for all of us, like, I don't think this is just an issue for students. I think it's for all of us. And I think this sort of, that the central idea that underpins a lot of what we're doing is to move away from all of these sort of, you know, banking models of education that I certainly grew up with, and I know Spencer did to a certain extent as well, where students just expect you to come in and sort of, you know, we'll give you some, you know, great little nuggets of knowledge that you can take away. But we're more about problem posing and about, you know, having students reflect on it themselves. And some are going to be deeper than others, and some are going to sort of be more reflective than others. But hopefully they'll all be at least prompted to think a little bit more deeply about their media use and, you know, issues of representation and ideology and power and, you know, all sorts of those big topics.
There's, you know, the small things, right?
Yeah.
So I guess another question that I always tend to have when thinking about encouraging this critical thinking, higher level engagement with these sorts of media and digital literacy skills is that inevitably there's going to be some pushback. And I'm curious from the student's perspective, if you experienced any of that that pushback. I also want to ask you about your colleagues as well, but from the student perspective, did you have anyone that was sort of like, you know, why are we doing this? Give me my checklist.
Yeah, I think, I mean, not explicitly, but I think the idea that students can think for themselves and have to wrestle with this material and they're not going to get, you know, some kind of authoritative answer from a professor is a shift for some students, you know, who are used to sitting, as I did when I was a college student, you sit in a lecture hall, you take the notes, and there's very little interaction. So there's always going to be some resistance to that. And also, I think these sort of ideas of what a professor is supposed to do is very much wrapped up with sort of standing at the top of the classroom and, you know, sort of preaching to your class, if you like. So there's definitely some resistance. Not everybody buys in, but I think that's the case for whatever, you know, approach you take in the classroom.
Yeah, and I think, you know, from my perspective, I think some of the students were wondering why the librarian was in the classroom all the time. They were sort of used to, you know, how do you, you know, coming to me or having me in class, you know, how just to sort of show them essentially how to use the databases and where to locate those on the library website. So, you know, my role in there, I think, was a bit confusing to some of them at first when we first started.
So how did you get past that?
We had to provide that context. You know, we didn't do a good job of it the first iteration of the class, but we learned from that. And so we had to sort of place media literacy and information literacy and sort of my role in the context in the class at the outset.
And I think once the students realize that we're both equally responsible for the class, we're both doing the grading, then they were fine with it. But it was a little bit of a shift because that wasn't something that happened a lot in our institution.
Yeah, so that sort of lends to the other side that I was curious about. You're having to convince, or you've had to convince the students that this partnership between a librarian and their instructor is something, you know, that's important for this particular topic. Let's be honest, from the library perspective, we think we're, you know, we should be in all of those relationships, but in this particular topic. So did you get any pushback, or maybe not pushback, but just sort of confounded looks from your colleagues?
Yeah, I think there was a little head scratching because, like I suggested a second ago, you know, that it isn't a norm. I mean, it was the norm to have a librarian in the classroom, but not necessarily in an equitable role with the professor. But that's just at our institution. I know it's not the same everywhere. So, yeah, I think there was a little head scratching. And why would you attempt to bring these two fields together? And for us, it seemed like a natural fit. And this is, I think, one of the advantages of working at a small institution is that we were both able to make that maneuver. And once we renamed the class Media and Information Literacy, I think there was sort of more acceptance that these two things do go together, even though some people might not be sure exactly what we're doing. But as time went on, I think there was less of that.
I think, too, what had helped is when Natasha first taught the media literacy course, it, you know, it is required for some different majors and minors. And it did, you know, now become relatively recently a general education requirement course at Blackburn.
That's great.
So we did gain some momentum there, I think, with it, even though people, I don't think, you know, it's still tough for, you know, to fully understand it. But it did, you know, we did make some headway with it.
Yeah, and I think we could also point to some other models, like, you know, the UNESCO model's been around for a while, where they bring media and information literacy together, not always with a maybe an obvious critical perspective, but certainly they're making the argument for why those two fields should be brought together, as lots of other theorists have. So we're able to sort of borrow from that literature too, which I think helped, you know, us to make the case at a local level.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And I that's one of the things that I've been really impressed with the work that the two of you have done together in this area, is that you're putting it beyond the context of just the single classroom experience, right? You're pulling in some of the other frameworks and examples of these types of collaborations that are happening beyond even just higher ed, which was something that I also was, I just have a lot of questions and curiosities about your work. So I did want to ask you too, just about that, non-higher ed. I noticed, I think I saw, a line somewhere, Natasha, that you'd said that, information and media literacy are traditionally siloed and that there is a lot of focus in K-12 on some of these topics, but there's not that blended focus in higher ed. So I guess I would like to know from your perspectives what the role of the college classroom is for this type of instruction and investigation.
Yeah, I think it's the perfect role, you know, place to do it. And I think for us, it's become, and it was a little, you know, honestly, it was a little bit of a shift because I was used to being the only person in my classroom who was instructing. And so there was also, I had to be willing to sort of give up some of the space in the classroom and really commit to learning more about the critical and information literacy, you know, areas. And I think that's what actually ended up making our partnership valuable and equitable, is that we both delved into each other's areas. It wasn't just, okay, if something information literacy comes up, Spencer will handle it, and vice versa with media literacy with myself. So, and the classroom is a perfect place to work that out because you can always tinker with it. You can always try new things, what worked, what didn't. Like Spencer already said, we learned from the first time we taught it that we had to be much more explicit about why these two fields are separate, but why we think they should be together. Because, you know, our students are working in a liberal arts education environment. You need to help them, or at least facilitate that process for them. You know, how do these things connect, and what are the relationships between these areas and other areas that they might be studying? So I think that's imperative, like I said, especially in a, you know, in a traditional liberal arts setting, to help the students understand that context.
Yeah, I'm thinking again back to the first time we taught this, and going back to what Natasha said about, you know, she'd take the pieces on media literacy and then I would take the piece of the class on information literacy. So it was a lot more rigid, you know, the classroom environment was a little more rigid when we started, and it just seemed to get more and more flexible, and there was sort of a better flow, in terms of, discussion and what topics and ideas, that were brought to the classroom. It seemed more open. And more of a comfortable environment than a traditional classroom setting.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, flexibility is important in the classroom anyway, but particularly when you're trying to blend some of these topics that maybe people haven't really thought about them as one and the same. So what about other faculty and librarians that may be interested in incorporating some of these topics related to critical media literacy, critical information literacy? Can you envision a scenario where maybe some of these types of activities that you have your students do, which if you've got some examples, that would be fantastic, but that could maybe fit into a disciplinary focus?
Yeah, I mean, I think the ones that come to mind are some of the sort of more successful ones. Obviously, we have a unit on remix, and I think that's one of the areas that you really see media literacy and information literacy come together with, that sort of under that critical pedagogy heading.
Could you talk a little bit more about what that unit looks like?
Yeah, sure. So, Spencer, do you wanna jump into?
Yeah. So we talk about remix culture. There's a DVD called RIP, a Remix Manifesto, and it talks about copyright and fair use, and I think a bit on Creative Commons as well. But it talks about sort of how it follows a DJ who sort of remixes older music into sort of his own almost. and how he does that, and sort of, is he, you know, ideas about, is he violating copyright, and is that work, you know, whose work is that? And so we talk about how you sort of, even when you're sort of writing a paper, you know, are you creating something new, or are you simply remixing different knowledge for your, you know, for your argument and what your perspective is? So we watch that movie. We have those sort of, I guess, large discussions on those big topics. That's sort of one area.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think that also leads then into questions of, you know, plagiarism, open access, what is copyright? That's connected, obviously, to ownership. And so all of these sort of larger issues come out as you're discussing the idea of remix, because I think a lot of students get really hung up on original papers, you know, this sort of, in quotation marks, having to write original papers. And they sort of very much stress out that they have to create something from scratch when nobody's doing that. But I don't think that there's a lot of honesty around that discussion, in particularly in academia, which is why something that seems fairly trivial, maybe at first, like this video, sort of opens up all these wider discussions about the nature of research, plagiarism, access, you know, paywalls, who gets to say when something goes into a quote unquote authoritative journal, who makes those decisions, how are they making those decisions, who's getting left out, who's being marginalized by those decisions. So that's always a pretty interesting unit to go through with the students. And I should say that, you know, we've also borrowed from other people working in both of our fields. And for that reason, that we do all our work open. So our syllabus or our lesson plans, we're happy to share with anybody who's interested in sort of seeing a little bit more of the specifics of what we do in classes.
Oh, that's great. And I love that you're living the philosophy of openness. You're teaching it, but you're living it. And that if you have links or anything that you would like to share, we can definitely add those along with the podcast information. So if listeners want to check that out, that's great. So I also wanted to ask you, kind of shifting away from the course and some of the curricular areas that you've been focusing on here, just wanted to ask about your blog. The two of you co-write a blog called No Silos, is that right?
Yeah, we both have our own separate websites. Natasha's, her blog is No Silos, and then, I mean, you're right, we do co-write them, and then we put them on our own websites.
So Spencer, what's your website called?
Converging Spaces.
Okay, so you've got Converging Spaces and No Silos, which we will also link to for you. But what are some of your goals through sharing your work this way?
I think one is we've been able to connect with a lot of great people, you know, working in maybe similar areas or doing some similar things that we wouldn't have been able to know before, to connect with. That's one reason why. And also, you know, like we said, in terms of working openly, we also want to, you know, give credit to people that have shared their work with us and have helped us, you know, progress through our work too. And also, I think to share what we're doing with other librarians and other educators.
And it's, you know, it's often true writing a blog. We don't do it as often as we should, or I certainly am not doing it as often as I should. But I think it also helps you reflect about when you go to a conference or you have an idea or, you know, you have an experience related to this. It's also a good model for students to see that you're, you know, it's a much more sort of conversational style. You know, yes, we write academic papers and go to quote unquote academic conferences, but, you know, there are other ways to share that information. And I'm always interested in reaching a wider audience. I don't know if this is true or not. I probably should find out. But someone once told me that the average academic paper gets read, has 5 readers. I mean, which is kind of shocking. Yeah, I know. It's shocking, right? When you think about the work you put into that. I mean, it's really disheartening. And I want, frankly, more than academics reading my work too. So I think there's a level of accessibility when you write a blog that, you know, isn't always there when you're doing something for a specific journal or a specific book.
Yeah, and I like that you mention that you pull in this idea of using the blog as a way of reflecting on your, you know, not just your own work, but your conversations, your professional sort of network at conferences. And two, that also is a really good modeling technique for students because it's diving deeper than, you know, just a summary. You're reflecting and thinking and trying to find connections. So that's fantastic. Natasha, where did you say you're calling us from today?
I'm actually in Portugal right now. I was over here for a Le Mans sabbatical, but I was also here for a media literacy research symposium. Spencer presented virtually with me. So yeah, that was pretty cool.
Yeah, that's very cool, and very cool that you're calling us from Portugal. Thank you for that. Before we wrap up, is there anything else you'd like to mention or maybe some last tips for others that are wanting to embark on these types of collaborations to teach critical media and information literacy?
I was just going to say one thing that Spencer's actually taught me through this process is to be less, I don't know if fearful is the right word, but certainly less hesitant to reach out to people because he's really good at that. He'll drop somebody a line and, you know, if people are interested or they want to network a little bit or are genuinely interested in your work, they'll follow up. And I've gotten much better at that as a result. And I think it's really important because the only way you're sort of going to you know, learn more about what it is that you're doing is to put your work out there a little bit. So that would be a tip for people who sometimes feel like, oh, you know, I shouldn't talk to them or whatever. I mean, we all have our sort of, you know, theory crushes. This is getting really academically nerdy now. And sometimes you're a little intimidated to go talk to them. But I, like I said, because of Spencer, I think I've gotten much better at that.
Wow, that's great.
I think too, sometimes, you know, when you're practicing the critical pieces, sometimes you can feel isolated at times. And so I think it's good to reach out and see what other people are doing. I mean, I don't, you know, if I didn't think about reaching out to Melissa, there's no way we would ever be able to have a conversation, you know? I think too, you know, I do want to reiterate that, people should definitely feel free to reach out and ask us for, you know, information about the course or things that we've written, or other resources that we maybe have curated. We're definitely willing to help out and have those conversations.
Oh, that's fantastic. Thank you so much. Before we officially wrap up, I've got one more question to ask each of you. This is something that we ask on every Leading Lines podcast interview. And that is, what is your favorite analog educational technology?
I think, you know, something simple that I do in some of the classes is you can't go wrong with a big giant sheet of paper and a bunch of markers, you know, and do a little, crowd sourcing, if you like, with the students in a room. I mean, just because we use all this digital, it's no excuse to get away from the basics. We still have to communicate with each other in the room in person. So,
you know, I'm looking out in the library right now, and both of our big mobile whiteboards are being used by groups of students. And so I think that's, you know, one thing. And I know when I was at Blackburn, too, that was a popular learning tool. So I would have to say that these mobile whiteboards, I would still go back and use a whiteboard.
Yeah, that's great. I know, I think all the people that I respect the most still have whiteboards somewhere, you know, in their office or somewhere, and then they're just full of scribbles.
Yes, yes, exactly.
That's where all the best ideas come from, I think, the scribbles.
The scribbles, yes. Well, thank you both so very much. It's really been a pleasure to talk with you, and I know that you had to do some rearrangements with your schedules given your locations, but it's been wonderful to hear about this collaboration and just how deep you've gone with it and incorporating the critical piece, I think, is so important right now. And I'm really excited.
Yeah, it was great to talk to you, and thanks for your interest. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I really appreciate it, Melissa. Thank you for arranging this.
That was Natasha Casey, Associate Professor of Communications at Blackburn College, and Spencer Brayton, Library Manager at Waubonsie Community College. Thanks to Melissa Mellon from the Vanderbilt Library for that interview. Casey and Brayton mentioned teaching in their course the documentary called RIP, A Remix Manifesto. That documentary features the DJ Greg Gillis, better known as Girl Talk. Some of his tracks are entirely composed of samples of songs by other musicians, layered together with what I think is great intentionality. I've shared his work with the students in my first year writing seminar in a unit on plagiarism and academic integrity, and it's helped generate really great conversations with them about copyright, plagiarism, creativity, and originality. I hadn't actually heard about that documentary, and I look forward to watching it. You can find a link to that documentary, as well as links to Casey and Brayton's blogs and Twitter accounts in this episode's show notes, which are available on our website, leadinglinespod.com. How do you go about teaching students media and information literacy? Melissa and I would love to hear more examples of activities and assignments along these lines. You can find her on Twitter at librarianlists with two S's, and you can find me at Derek Bruff. And you can find our show at Leading Lines Pod. We'd love to hear from you. Leading Lines is produced by the Center for Teaching, the Vanderbilt Institute for Digital Learning, the Office of Scholarly Communications, and the Associate Provost for Digital Learning. This episode was edited by Rhett McDaniel. Look for new episodes the first and third Monday of each month. I'm your host, Derek Bruff. Thanks for listening.